You were listening to a sermon by Anne-Marie Ellathorpe, recorded on Sunday, November 3rd, 2019, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here this morning. And thank you for the wonderful worship. The words of so many of those songs were just so much in alignment with what I want to share with you this morning. So within the Gospel of Matthew, we are reminded that God is ultimately in control. Not the powers of evil or oppression. Within the Sermon on the Mount, specifically, we are reminded of the righteousness or the right relatedness that God's people are called to. And in Matthew 5, in the passage we looked at this morning, we read of this right relatedness in relation to how God's people are to respond to oppression. In verse 39, Jesus firstly instructs his followers not to resist an evil person. The word there for resist, it would be better translated as to not strike back, to not retaliate. Because on first impressions, this do not resist sounds like a rather passive response to oppression. But Jesus invites his listeners to imagine examples of non-violent resistant action. And as we dig further into this text, we find that our response to oppression is to be anything but passive. So I want to paraphrase the examples that Jesus gives to highlight some aspects of their cultural context. Within a world characterized by physical assault and insulting behavior, if anyone demeans you with a backhanded slap on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek. Requiring them to treat you as an equal by striking you with an open palm, and thus robbing the oppressor of the power to humiliate. You've chosen how they're going to do it. Within a context characterized by exploitative lawsuits against people who have become impoverished, where there's a law against taking somebody's coat because it might be their only blanket to keep them warm, but there's nothing mentioned about shirts or tunics. If anyone wants to sue you for your shirt or your tunic, well, hand over your coat, your outer garment as well, thus shaming them as you leave the court naked. Within a world characterized by military occupation, where if a Roman soldier forces you to carry his pack for a mile, as is his legal right, you take the initiative by going with him 2 miles. 2 miles being illegal, but it's your choice. Within a world characterized by poverty and exploitation, give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from that impoverished person who wants to borrow from you. Jesus' call is to non-violent action in response to oppression. Not passivity. Non-violent action is not cowardly, but rather confronts in a creative manner. These instructions from Jesus, they're not rules to be rigidly applied, but rather they are life-giving, freedom-promoting alternatives to be imagined. Jesus frees his disciples to act rather than react in response to evil. He frees his followers to act creatively, compassionately and non-violently in response to oppression. So today I want to share with you two situations that demonstrate an outworking of the principles of this text. And after I've shut down that, towards the end, we'll make the friendship link that Rosie mentioned earlier. The first story that I want to share with you is that of the Palihapa community, an indigenous community in my home country, Aotearoa, New Zealand, in the late 19th century, led by two prophets and peace activists, Tohu Kakahi and Te Whiti o Rongomai. These practitioners and preachers of peace had been schooled in the scriptures. We don't tend to think of Māori as peace activists. I don't know if some of you are familiar with the movie Once Were Warriors. But yeah, there's, maybe you've seen the haka, maybe even recently with the rugby. You know, again, this sort of portrayal of aggression. But the reputation of Māori as peace activists is less well known and is counter to the colonial narrative that portrays Māori as violent and the colonisers as bringing peace. As will become evident, Parihaka was a place of peace, negatively impacted by the violence of the colonial government and its forces. This violence was largely related to land. In the Maori version of the Treaty of Waitangi, signed by many but not all tribal leaders in 1840, Maori gave kowanatanga, or governance, to the British Queen. They were encouraged to sign this treaty by the Anglican missionaries who had brought the gospel to New Zealand. And it was expected that such governance would ensure that Māori land was safe from settlers. Yet, this did not turn out to be the case. Part of the trouble was that there were two versions of the treaty, and in the English version of the treaty, Māori gave sovereignty, rangatiratanga, to the Queen. And that then paved the way for legislation that allowed for the confiscation of Māori land to punish tribes deemed to have engaged in open rebellion against the Queen through participation in land wars to try and keep their own land. And this legislation allowed for the confiscation of vast areas of the Taranaki region. Taranaki basically being this area here. And it is within this context that the village of Parihaka was established in Taranaki by Tohu and Te Whiti. These men were leaders, prophets, friends and brothers-in-law, and their teachings blended Māori and biblical ideas. Te Whiti and Tohu called upon their people to resist oppressive and violent colonial practices, including land confiscation, by peaceful means. And Māori from elsewhere in the country who were facing the impact of land confiscation were attracted to this community and found refuge within it. So by 1870, Parihaka had become the largest Māori village in Aotearoa. And somewhat of a threat, I think, to the colonial government. And so in 1879, the colonial government moved to occupy this land that, in theory, had been confiscated since the 1860s. And the colonial government engaged in acts of violence, such as the surveying of the land, the building of roads, and the construction of a web of telegraph poles. You don't maybe think of these things as violent. And they were, of course, bloodless, But for Māori and for the settlers that supported them, the government's intentions with these actions were nevertheless unjust and violent. So government armed forces took down garden fences built by Māori to make way for roads in the area. Yet these fences were needed to protect crops from cattle and from horses. So, in response, Māori rebuilt fences across the roads, wearing as they did orakaura, white albatross feathers in their hair to symbolise their commitment to peace. If you just go into the next one, you'll see white feathers in their hair. As government surveyors began to prepare the land for settlement by European settlers, Parihaka Māori responded by ploughing the land. I'm not sure if that's quite clear enough to see. So they responded by ploughing the land and pulling out the survey pegs. Their ploughing signified continued Māori ownership through occupation of the land. And as Kennedy Warren asserts, by using a farming implement introduced by the colonisers, they asserted their right to participate in the economy of the time on land taken in violation of the government's own word. Furthermore, the Parihaka prophets would have been aware of the religious symbolism of this act, reflecting as it did the biblical vision of swords being beaten into ploughshares. The ploughmen, however, were arrested, fined, and deported to Wellington or the South Island, where they were imprisoned. But worse was yet to come. 138 years ago from tomorrow, which will be November the 5th, in New Zealand, approximately 1,600 government troops invaded Parihaka. There they were met with children skipping, singing, dancing, and offering them bread. The adults sat in silence and passive resistance. However, the Riot Act was read, and subsequently Te Whiti and Tohu were arrested and taken away. And the following day, troops began to destroy Parihaka and to forcibly disperse its people. Te Whiti and Tohu were taken to the South Island, where they were held without trial for almost 2 years. And if you're interested to learn more from their jailer, Google this and find this book and hear what their jailer thought all about it. These two men were eventually returned to the ruined Parihaka settlement, where they continued to lead peaceful Māori protest, despite larger group meetings being prohibited. The colonisers subsequently celebrated the non-violent settlement of Taranaki. After all, no shots were fired on November the 5th, or subsequently, and the power of the prophets did seem to be diminished. Some may even say the prophets were defeated. Yet the moral victory was ultimately with the prophets and others who turned the other cheek by not engaging in non-violent resistance to oppression. By engaging in non-violent resistance to oppression. I can tell people are listening well. Te Whiti and Tohu died in 1907, and the newspaper death notice for Te Whiti celebrated the end of Parihaka's influence. Yet Parihaka's influence had not ended, and has not ended. As the New Zealand Waitangi Tribunal notes in their 1996 Taranaki report, Te Whiti and Tohu live on in people's hearts and minds. Whereas those who set out to destroy them, if their names can be found at all, are simply recorded on archival shelves. Furthermore, While the Parihaka community suffered greatly from the impact of the injustice and poverty and division within subsequent decades, the pillars of the contemporary Parihaka community continue to be principles of non-violence, empowerment of people who are disempowered by society, working together as a community, self-sufficiency and equality. And what's really, I think, fascinating to note is that the resistance movement of the Māori Parihaka community during the late 19th century in New Zealand is now being recognised as a forerunner to the recent tradition of non-violent resistance to oppression. The actions of Māori in this relatively remote corner of New Zealand has had a ripple effect, with concentric circles of influence impacting other areas of the globe in subsequent decades. Mahatma Gandhi learned about Parihaka from an Irish delegation that had visited there, as well as from accounts of the Parihaka protests in English newspapers. Gandhi's grandson recently confirmed that Gandhi's knowledge of Parihaka helped to develop his own pacifist understandings. And just a short time ago, on October the 24th, the New Zealand Crown apology for the invasion of Parihaka and the imprisonment of its people was passed into law. So I want to turn now to Martin Luther King, a second account of turning the other cheek through non-violent action in response to oppression. Martin Luther King is much more widely known and celebrated than the Parihaka prophets. Yet, Gandhi provides an interesting link between the two. Whereas the non-violent resistance of Parihaka was a source of inspiration for Gandhi, the non-violent resistance promoted by Gandhi was a source of inspiration for Martin Luther King. In 1956, Gandhi was somebody that King admired but didn't really know much about. He hadn't really deeply engaged his thought. But as King subsequently lived more deeply into the truths of the Sermon on the Mount, his copies of Gandhi's writings became worn and tattered. It's unlikely that King was familiar with the Parihaka prophets, but we can see similarities in terms of a vision of collaboration and justice that goes beyond one's own people, that is inspired by God and by Scripture, and that provokes the challenging of oppression and unjust laws through non-violent action. King's vision was for a beloved community, for a new social space of reconciliation that revealed God as being on the side of truth and love and justice. And to this end, King promoted the challenging of unjust laws of segregation. Yet it took him some time and the development of a sense of calling to be willing to do so. A congregational letter that he wrote in 1955 essentially reads, "Don't rock the boat." Following Rosa Parks' refusal to give up her seat on a segregated bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and a subsequent bus boycott, King called for fair access to public transport, but he initially did so without challenging state segregation laws that seemed just too entrenched to call into question. Yet, King's experience of the divine through a kitchen epiphany in January 1956 provided him with a sense of call that helped him to overcome his uncertainty and filled him with courage to stand up for righteousness and justice, including desegregation. While imprisoned in Birmingham jail for parading without a permit in April 1963, King specified four basic steps integral to any nonviolent campaign: a collection of the facts to determine whether justice exists, negotiation, self-purification, and direct action. Intriguingly, the 1996 Waitangi Tribunal report detailing the history of Parihaka notes these steps as effectively describing the path trod by Tohu into Fiji. Like the Parihaka prophets, King was actively committed to non-violence in the pursuit of justice. King advocated for non-violent resistance that intentionally seeks the good of the oppressors. King asserted we must love our white brothers. We must respond to violence with non-violence. We must meet hate with love. And so young black demonstrators risked their lives in a variety of non-violent responses to injustice, including marches, bus boycotts, and peaceful sit-ins at lunch counters where they were denied service because of skin colour. These actions were not to be regarded as ends in themselves. Rather, King asserts the ultimate end of non-violence is to win the friendship of the oppressor, to win the friendship of the opponent. King's ultimate goals were friendship, reconciliation, and redemption. Nevertheless, he was criticized by politicians, journalists, and clergy for engaging in peaceful demonstrations that, by stoking the anger of white supremacists, threatened to turn violent at any moment. And his life was indeed cut short by a white supremacist in 1968. Nevertheless, his legacy remains, as he too lives on in people's hearts and minds. His example is internationally recognised and continues to carry significant moral weight. So as I consider these two accounts of non-violent resistance to oppression, these two accounts of the outworking of Jesus' instructions in the Sermon on the Mount, what stands out for me is that Martin Luther King's vision of beloved community and the Parihaka prophet's vision for Māori and Pākehā to live in harmony are essentially visions of a pervasive culture of friendship that may be described as civic friendship. Within personal friendship, we want the best for our friends, and we're active on their behalf. We help them out. Civic friendship extends this willing good and this doing good to the broader community. Both King and the Parihaka prophets willed good for their oppressors, as well as for those suffering from injustice and oppression. And for Te Whiti, we see this in his response to charges following his 1881 arrest, where upon appearing before a magistrate, he was charged with, in short, disturbing the peace. And he responded by clearly stating that his vision was for all settlers, Pākehā and Māori, to live peacefully and happily on the land. His ideal was for Pākehā and Māori to live side by side in peace. Admittedly, with the Māori as the dominant ruler. Learning from the white man's wisdom, without becoming subservient to his immoderate greed. Quite well put, I think. King's vision of beloved community, whereby those who had been divided for centuries would come to live together peaceably, is likewise an expression of civic friendship. And I believe that these visions of civic friendship are reflective of the righteousness or the right relatedness that Jesus calls us to within the Sermon on the Mount. A right relatedness that extends love to enemies, that prays for those who oppress and who persecute, and that confronts oppression and injustice creatively. Through these verses, Jesus encourages those suffering from oppression to imagine and to live out creative, life-giving alternatives to violence, to violent resistance. We may not be suffering from oppression ourselves, but implicitly, we likewise are called to imagine and to live out civic friendship. A conviction that justice would ultimately prevail undergirded the actions of the Parihaka prophets and of Martin Luther King. Similarly, actively exposing and challenging various forms of injustice, including unjust laws and social customs, may well be a necessary outworking of civic friendship inspired and empowered by Jesus. Civic friendship inspired by Jesus and by his teachings includes the valuing of all, the oppressor and the oppressed. Such valuing will contribute to non-compliance with acts of injustice and violence. Such valuing may also require actions that compassionately expose the violence of the oppressor in order to promote change. Valuing all and wanting the best for all may well include various forms of non-violent direct action in order to create crisis and tension to the point where a community that has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront rather than continue to ignore the issue and to open the door to negotiation. Here in Canada, in New Zealand, in the United States, and elsewhere, there is a continued need for a vision of civic friendship inspired and empowered by Jesus to foster the valuing of all people, to inspire commitment to injustice, to non-violent resistance to oppression, and to peace. Like the Parihaka prophets and their community, like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and others, may we too have the courage to stand up for righteousness and justice. May we also stand for peace, for justice, and for friendship. Thank you.